Welcome to the Eco News Report. My name is Tom Wheeler. I am your host this week, and I am joined, as always, by my friends Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Good morning, Tom.
Scott Greason of Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom.
And Jen Cault of Humble Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
Jen is going to be kind of our featured guest for today's show. We're talking with Jen about king tides. So let's just start off with what the heck a king tide even is.
A king tide is the sort of colloquial name that's been given to the extreme high tides of the year. So it happens when either there's a new moon or a full moon, and there's more gravitational pull on the tides, and the tides are much higher. So I think people in Australia coined the term king tide.
It is a cute term. And so what time of year are our king tides generally?
They're generally during the solstices, but typically we have higher tides during the winter solstice period just because it's stormier, there's a lot more rain, low pressure causes the ocean to basically expand, take up more space. So there's more water piling up on the shore in the wintertime.
So king tides are something that we're interested in, not just because we like to go out and watch the ocean and whatever else, but because they are some sort of a predictor of the future, right? Or they give us a glimpse into what the future might look like.
Right. People have heard a lot about sea level rise predictions and that the Humboldt Bay area is subject to twice the rate of sea level rise as the state average. But, you know, it's one thing to read that in a sentence or hear someone say it, and it's a totally different thing to go and see for yourself what is it going to look like when the ocean is actually a foot higher, which is predicted now for the year 2030. So we use the king tides as a way to get people looking at the water levels in and around Humboldt Bay in particular to think about what will a king tide look like on top of that, you know, with another foot on top of a king tide.
And king tides are also at this point that we are most vulnerable to other things like large storm events or the cumulative effect of a large storm event and a king tide could have pretty drastic impacts. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, in the wintertime, we get some pretty ripping storms here sometimes. If they coincide with a king tide, there's a lot of coastal flooding. You know, if the winds are pushing the water up on shore and there's a lot of rain, so there's nowhere for the water to go because the low-lying areas are very saturated and the groundwater is sitting on top of the soil like it does in the late winter here, the flooding is a lot worse.
Yeah, we just had a bomb cyclone come through the area about a month ago, and it's super low pressure, some of the lowest pressure ever recorded in the area, and it created quite a upwelling of the ocean, but the wind was blowing from the southeast, so it was kind of pushing the ocean back out. Had the cyclone come through a little bit sooner in conjunction with the tide and the winds come from the north or northwest, I think it would have been a different story. So it was just a few hours made a big difference in that particular event.
And if people remember back in, was it New Year's Eve or New Year's Day? 2006, right. New Year's Day, I think it was. There was a king tide. That was actually the highest tide on record in Humboldt Bay, 9.5 feet at the North Spit tide gauge. And there was a massive storm event, too, really windy. And the two southbound lanes of Highway 101 between Arcata and Eureka were flooded, completely flooded. And there's pictures of the Indianola cutoff intersection totally underwater. And then when the water receded, it's, you know, covered in driftwood. Pretty dangerous driving conditions, to say the least.
Yeah, and just a week or so ago at the high tide, you know, with the last full moon, I've been driving along Humboldt Bay at, you know, roughly the high tide, and it's full. I mean, the water's way up underneath that break in the railroad tracks, you know, that probably most people are familiar with who drive along Humboldt Bay. You know, there's that one section where the levee's gone, but the tracks are still hanging above what's usually mud flats. But when the tide is high, the water's right under there. And it's very, very clear that the level of the water on the, you know, the bay side is much higher than the level of the ground on the other side. It's making very clear to me how much of the land around Humboldt Bay is subject to inundation as soon as one of our, you know, aging levees breaks.
Right. And that's because those lands, those pasture lands on the inland side of 101 used to be tidal wetlands.
Right.
And so when they were diked off, you know, 120 years ago or so, 100 years ago, sea level was 18 inches lower than it is today. But then also the effect of taking the water out of the wetlands and turning it into pasture made the land sink or subside about 3 feet. So if a levee or a dike breaks, basically rushes into that low-lying area, and then the rest of the dike that's not eroded away or breached acts like a dam keeping the water in.
Right.
On top of all that, you have the rising groundwater. So as the sea level rises, the groundwater is going to be rising. Like I said, the reason in late winter here you see these big, you know, ponds with ducks hanging out on them, that's groundwater sitting on top of the surface of the soil.
Right.
So there's nowhere for the water to go.
And now we've decided to just rebuild part of the highway totally just the same, right?
Yeah, basically.
So this gets back to our show on the 101 improvement project.
Right. So Caltrans started about 17 years ago planning a project, close off all the median crossings for safety, build an interchange at Indianola Cutoff, and then they will be building a stoplight, their intersection at Jacobs Avenue. But the southern part of the safety corridor, the part by the California Redwood Company Mill and Jacobs Avenue, that whole stretch for about a mile is projected to be flooded on a regular basis by 2030. So 10 years. And we're about to spend over $100 million on this project.
Let me just pull out two facts from what you just said. Caltrans has been planning this project for 17 years, but they haven't even started yet. And the lower part, basically the southern third of the safety corridor, is expected to be flooding regularly in 10 years.
That's right. Yep. I mean, it really highlights my fear that we're not going to be able to adapt to this in time. And as biologists, we talk about species not being able to evolve quickly enough for climate change. But I'm starting to really have doubts that humans are going to be able to adapt our thinking, our thought process. You know, what are we going to do? What are those people on Jacobs Avenue going to do if there's only one way out and it's flooded? That would never stand in a wildfire situation today. We would figure out an emergency exit for people. But that area is an island that was salt marsh, was diked off, turned into ag land, and then it was turned into commercial and industrial land, and there's an RV park on that island. You know, it's worrisome for lots of reasons. I mean, that area doesn't have storm drains either. So when the tide comes in, you just have to wait for the tide to go back out, for the water to go out. And then there's also all these, you know, there's a junkyard, there's all kinds of industry there that puts the bay at risk from pollution once all that area gets flooded.
So you bring up junkyards and other things. We have other areas that are high risk when we have these inundation events, contaminated areas. Can you talk about some of these low-lying contaminated areas?
Sure. That's one of Baykeeper's top priorities is looking at these former lumber mills that have a lot of contamination. Quite a few of them are contaminated with dioxins, which are very long-lasting carcinogenic and reproductive toxins that are left over from a wood preservative that was used at a lot of lumber mills. And there used to be over 100 lumber mills around Humboldt Bay. A lot of them were built on wetland fill. So people said, hey, you know, wetlands, they're useless. Bring in a bunch of soil from who knows where and build a mill on top of them. And some of them have been partially cleaned up, but there's still contaminated groundwater beneath them. As the groundwater rises, it'll become more connected to the tides with the bay and start to pollute the bay. So we're working on trying to get some of these, more of them, cleaned up as best we can. It's, you know, it's tough because our legal system is such that you can only really do much if someone's planning on redeveloping the site, or if it's purchased by a government agency or nonprofit, like the Harbor District bought the pulp mill and then we're able to get grant funds to clean it up. Or the third option is litigation.
Roughly how many sites do you sort of view as really high priority around the bay?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there's probably a dozen sites that are high priority. Like I said, some of them have been partially cleaned up, but there's still contaminated groundwater beneath them that's not going anywhere right now. It's not moving with the tide. It's just sitting under a site like the Sierra Pacific Mill in Manila or the Simpson Plywood Mill in Eureka. But then there are other sites that have not been cleaned up that we know are contaminated, like the Little Lake Industries property on South I Street in Arcata. About half of that property is projected to be flooded with a meter of sea level rise by the year 2060. And then there are other sites that are just unknowns because they've never been tested.
Do you have a site that worries you the most?
That's a good question. Well, I guess the Little Lake Industries is my top worry right now because I've done a real deep dive on the history of that site, and we know there's a hot spot of dioxin in the bay sediment right off the mouth of Butcher's Slough. You know, the city of Arcata has talked about making it into a dog park, and they recently just did some sampling and found that, yes, there's quite a bit of dioxin on that site. And, you know, it's an old mill that the city decided to reroute Butcher's Slough right through the middle of in a restoration project in the 1980s. And it's, you know, very high use both by wildlife and by people. So that site worries me quite a bit.
And what can we do about dioxin? So you talk about site reclamation. What does that even mean?
Well, it depends on the site. In upland sites where you're not dealing with contaminated bay sediment, it involves a lot of removal of the soil and trucking it away from water. So trucking it off to a hazardous waste facility.
Where that soil is then burned or
no,
buried?
No, it's just buried away from water, theoretically. It's not a very elegant solution, to be sure. In some cases, there can be chemical remediation, but I don't know that that works in bay sediments. So, you know, a lot of it is just removing the soil to get it away from water.
Which underscores the hazard here, that we've got these lenses of polluted groundwater basically just waiting to be connected to the larger bay system by rising groundwater. And that's going to happen, you're telling us, that as the sea level rises, which the king tides are telling us, you know, those are going to be mixed in if we don't fix them.
Yeah, and, you know, dioxin is carried more by sediment than by water typically, but as these sites erode, the sediment is carried off into the bay. And one of the concerns about dioxin I should mention is that they biomagnify. So they move up the food chain and are stored in the fat. As you go higher up a food chain, it's more and more concentrated. So animals, including us who eat higher on the food chain, are more subject to exposure. This is quickly turning into a dioxin show instead of a king tide show. But I do want to talk about that just because that is one of Baykeeper's top priorities, is thinking about those low-lying areas that'll be flooded in our lifetimes.
Speaking of those low-lying areas, you said that, you know, a lot of these places were salt marshes before we diked and drained them and turned them into ag lands. But if we were to, you know, in some places, let a levee or a dike fail, or if it were to just fail on its own, some of these areas wouldn't actually go back to being salt marshes at this point, because as you pointed out, they've subsided so much. And so we'd actually see mud flats there, not salt marshes. What can we do about that?
Well, what's
can we get those salt marshes back? It seems like we kind of need them.
We can get those salt marshes back. What we can do is bring in fill from other areas to raise the elevation of those mud flats so that it turns into salt marsh.
Fill with no dioxin.
Right, exactly. You have to make sure you're not bringing in contaminated fill when you do that. So an area that's very visible to a lot of people where this is in process still is called the White Slough Restoration Project on the Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge. As you are driving on Highway 101 South or riding your bike on Highway 101 South, when you get to the Tompkins Hill exit by College of the Redwoods and look off towards the bay, you will see the White Slough Restoration Area. So it's an area where the dikes were failing and quite close to the highway. And so the refuge decided to do a restoration project in which they will bring in fill to develop salt marsh over time. And the idea is it's basically what people mean when they say a living shoreline. So instead of having a dike or a seawall, which is a really short-term fix that causes a lot of other problems as well, putting more salt marsh in front of whatever the infrastructure is that you want to protect will help absorb storm waves and prevent erosion by, you know, preventing the waves from crashing up against the highway itself.
So instead of a wall that's kind of brittle, you've got something that's more like a flexible, absorbing thing. Yeah.
Well, and also the salt marshes can catch sediment and build up over time. Mm-hmm. So with a seawall, what ends up happening is it causes more erosion and you just lose whatever's in front of it. And then you just have water crashing up against the seawall. So something like 12% of the California coastline has seawalls built on it now.
12%?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and the California Coastal Commission is not big on building more seawalls because what happens is the beach gets completely eroded in front of the wall and we lose the beach, we lose whatever habitat there was. It's a really short-sighted and short-term and very expensive fix.
So what about the ecological values of those salt marshes? I mean, you talk about their value as a buffer for roads and infrastructure, but the refuge must be also looking at that salt marsh as putting back, you know, some of the things that the refuge is there to protect, habitat.
Yeah, definitely. The salt marshes are a really unique habitat. We've destroyed about 90% of the salt marshes in the Humboldt Bay area and really in the whole state of California.
Right.
But of course, they're important for all the plants that they support. There's some rare plants that grow in salt marshes like the Humboldt Bay owl's clover, but they're also important for basically just filtering out a lot of pollution, probably critical to restoring coho populations.
Right. They're a big part of the estuary system that we need more of, basically, to get our fish fat and happy and on their way to the ocean. Yeah.
You're listening to the Eco News Report. We're talking with Jen Kalt about king tides, those highest tides of the year in Humboldt Bay. So you have a program to track king tides over time and to kind of see the progress of climate change and of sea level rise. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is our 10th year, surprisingly. Time flies. 10th year of doing the King Tide Photo Initiative. In 2011, Alderon Laird suggested it to Baykeeper that we start a King Tide Photo Initiative and get people out looking at the highest tides of the year, taking photos. And the idea is to take photos of the water level up against man-made structures so that you can compare it over time to either low tide or an average tide. I believe you all, Scott and Larry, have both participated in the King Tide Photo Initiative over the years, and we have a pretty massive archive of photos now. But, you know, we send people out to critical areas like the Arcata Wastewater Treatment Facility, which is predicted to be flooded on a monthly basis by the year 2040. So that's pretty critical.
That's okay. We just won't flush those times.
Mm-hmm. Hold it.
You'd have to be preemptive there. You'd have to stop flushing a couple weeks before the event. But yeah.
So other areas that are really of interest are bridges, anywhere where Highway 101 or 255 crosses streams or sloughs. The railroad dike that you talked about, I was just looking at a series starting in 2012 that shows massive change at that breached dike there on the railroad. It's just north of Breakut.
Right.
It started off pretty
small.
Right at
the end of the bike path, basically.
Yeah. Now you could pretty much drive a car underneath the railroad tracks at low tide.
At low tide, yeah.
What happens is the water comes in and, you know, the water rushing in and out is just eroding the hell out of it. So yeah, if people want to get involved in that, they can go to our website and we'll have ideas for where you can go photograph. Anywhere on the shoreline where there's man-made structures is great. We'll have photo tips like, you know, you don't need a nice camera. You can just take a great photo with a phone these days, but a good photo tip is just generally keep your back to the sun and your photos will turn out much better. I like to have a lot of water in the foreground because those tend to have more impact when people are looking at how much water there is.
It's interesting. Jen's had me going to behind Target, I don't know, every other year for quite a while. I've been going there, and this year the water came up right like a foot below the railroad trestle there that crosses behind Target. But what I noticed is it seems to have reached a peak of how high it's going to come up there, because it's starting to just inundate everything around there. So it's only going to come up so high before it just starts flooding everything else.
Well, it's reached a point where it's at the top of the channel, you're
right.
saying.
Yes.
It's hitting the flats above the channel.
Exactly.
So there's a lot more water that'll produce a lot more flooding without raising the level a lot.
Right. And the other thing that I wanted to bring up that we hadn't talked about yet is the numerous homeless camps along the bay that every time these king tides happen, all their belongings just get taken out to the bay.
Yeah, and we've had homeless advocates contact us to talk about when the highest tides will be, because they want to do a bunch of outreach to get people aware and move away from the danger and move their belongings so that they don't get swept away. And then also the National Weather Service has contacted us asking for photos, because surprisingly to me, they use some of our photos to predict where coastal flooding will occur. So this year, the highest tides of the year are going to be both on weekend days. So it's a great opportunity for people to get out January 10th to 12th. So that's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and February 8th and 9th, Saturday and Sunday. So the highest tide is predicted for Saturday, January 11th, and that's predicted to be an 8.25-foot tide at the North Spit Gauge. And it will be around 10:45 in the morning, I believe. But it's important to remember that depending on where you plan to photograph, the tide could be an hour later or earlier. So you need to check the tide gauge at the site that you plan to go. So King Salmon is a popular place to go because it's one of the most at-risk communities around the bay, along with Fields Landing and Fairhaven, very low-lying areas. So people like to go and photograph those areas because the flooding there tends to be pretty dramatic. Also, the Arcata Bottoms, Liscomb Slough, typically floods Jackson Ranch Road right near the bridge over the road. And it's very picturesque with the old barn. And I have some great photos of Mark Lovelace canoeing at the level of the road, basically looking at somebody driving by in a car that Ted Halstead took some years ago.
And that's something I would add as an avid kayaker. It's an awesome day to go out in the bay on your kayak because you can access areas that you can't normally get to.
It's a great day for bird watching, too, when the king tides are happening, because the birds cluster in the very few areas that are still exposed. So you can see everywhere along the bay margin, tons and tons of birds clustered on a few little pieces of wood sticking out of the water. We should talk about what can we do about what we know is going to happen, too, because that's really important. I mean, that's the whole point of doing this, is to get people thinking about what's going to happen in 10, 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we really need to do is stop spending tons of public money rebuilding infrastructure like the Highway 101 safety corridor without planning for this, because we know it's coming. And the short-term solutions are going to last even less time as time goes on, because every time a new projection or a new study comes out, it's happening faster and faster because we're failing to mitigate the rate at which the climate is changing.
Jen, when you say the short-term solutions, you mean things like the hard armoring, the levees, the seawalls?
Just rebuilding things in place. You know, if we're going to do, for example, the city of Arcata is planning a $65 million upgrade to the wastewater treatment facility without moving it. And the plan as it stands today is to just do that.
So we're just going to build a wall around something that's at sea level already?
That's the city of Arcata's plan at this point, is to cross their fingers and hope that the Coastal Commission is going to approve a 17-foot levee system all around South G Street, making it a peninsula.
So we're going to have our wastewater treatment system in a giant bathtub. what happens when
that's filling up from the backside. What happens then is you have to start building massive pumps to pump the water out, which is what's happening in Miami. And then, and you know, what happens then is you are pumping all kinds of polluted water out into the bay.
Great system.
It's not long-term thinking. In fact, the city of Morro Bay just recently got approval to move their entire wastewater treatment plant inland, and they're going to spend about twice what the city of Arcata is proposing. But they're also going to make it a zero discharge facility, basically. I shouldn't say zero discharge. It's not going to discharge to surface waters. So they're going to recycle a bunch of the water in what they call the purple pipes for irrigation. But then they're also going to treat water to a standard that they can discharge it to groundwater. So they're using it to recharge the groundwater system in an area where there's a lot of water shortages and people rely on groundwater for drinking and domestic water supply.
The science fiction writer William Gibson has said the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And it seems like the King Tides sort of bring that observation to life, you know, that this is the future. It's going to be here January 10th through 12th and February 8th to 9th. But what's that going to be like 10 and 20 years from now when, as you said, we're going to have monthly flooding at the site of the wastewater treatment plants? What are the King Tides going to look like in 20 years?
Exactly. You know, at what point is it just nuisance flooding that you can deal with on an emergency basis? And at what point is it unsustainable and you just need to move? And
255 isn't even going to work as a road anymore. Yeah.
Right.
Boy, we've got some challenges.
I said something at the beginning of the show that I meant to explain, that the Humboldt Bay area is experiencing twice the rate of sea level rise as the state average. And that usually gets some puzzled looks, like, how can that be? It's because the ground beneath the Humboldt Bay area is sinking at the same rate that sea level's rising because of tectonic activity. And so the opposite is true in Crescent City. The ground is uplifting at the same rate as sea level is rising. So in Crescent City, there's basically zero relative sea level rise.
Lucky them.
So I noticed on the East Coast, because the Atlantic has been warming, that they're having an increased. But I've been monitoring ocean temperatures in the Pacific, and they're raising too. They're higher than they used to be 20, 30 years ago. So that's got to play into the mix too, because warmer water expands.
That's right. That is definitely a factor. There's a lot of different factors. And, you know, honestly, we probably don't know what all the factors are. We think we're so smart, but there's probably some things we haven't really studied yet. That just the other day, a study came out that waters off California are acidifying faster than elsewhere, too. And that is just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. So what's that mean?
Well, it means that the ocean life is going to drastically change before our eyes.
Get used to an ocean full of jellyfish.
Yeah. Well, that's being caused, let's call it, from Asia, China, and other countries that are continuing to increase the amount of coal that they're burning, and the prevailing winds are coming right. All of our storms are birthed offshore of Japan.
I would also say that it's also our fault, we too, because this. we just denied a wind project.
Well, I'm talking about the Pacific Ocean. The prevailing wind doesn't carry any of our mess into the Pacific. It carries it into the Atlantic.
But it's global CO2 concentrations that affect
acidification, though, is coming from the fallout.
No,
it's a global phenomenon. It's a consequence of the global burden.
It's worse where you have the coal ash falling from the sky into
the
ocean.
That's true of mercury deposition. I don't think it's true of carbon.
I'm not an expert on ocean acidification.
We can have a bet that we can set up for a future show.
Cool.
That,
yeah. We should have a future show on ocean acidification, because it's a complex topic and it's terrifying. But I have read that stormwater pollution exacerbates it quite a bit. So there are ocean acidification hotspots off places like Seattle and San Francisco.
And I have a friend who is suing confined animal feeding operations, factory farms, because of nutrient inputs that are causing acidification. Andrea Rogers, what up?
There's a study going on here with UC Sea Grant and Hog Island Oyster Company are doing a study on the pH levels in Humboldt Bay waters. researchers have some preliminary indication that eelgrass buffers pH levels. And so the water in the bay is a little bit higher pH than in the ocean. And so it's
a little less acidic.
Yeah, it's a little less acidic, which is critical for the oyster industry, too. Any shell forming creatures can't form shells, where their shells don't develop properly.
They literally start to dissolve if the acid level's too high in the water they're in.
And with oysters, the larvae don't even start to set seed, is what they call it, but form shells if the pH levels are too low. And so this has been happening in Puget Sound and off the coast of Oregon quite a bit. And the state of Washington invested something like $500,000 in ocean monitoring system, where when the pH levels drop, the oyster hatcheries can, you know, shut off their intakes and add lime and do things to raise the pH levels. You know, the oyster farmers are really on the leading edge of this. They're seeing the effects already.
And they've already moved their seed production from outside of the Puget Sound.
Right. And the Humboldt Bay area seed operations have something like quintupled in the last 5 years or so. And that's in part because of those operations moving away from Puget Sound because of the acidic waters there.
So what you're saying is that there's a silver lining and economic development is coming as a result of global climate change.
For now.
Things are changing, that's for sure.
All right. So Jen, if people are interested in taking some photos of the king tides, getting out, going on their kayak, or just kind of going out on foot and taking photos of the shoreline, where should they go? What do they need to know?
Well, the first thing they need to know is be very careful. A lot of times the way the human brain works is we think nature's static and things don't change. So unfortunately, a lot of times that means people drive through big puddles on roads and get stuck because they don't realize how deep the water is. But on the coast, there can be a lot of erosion. And so be very careful. And also be very careful of vehicles. A lot of times these places are along roads. And so, you know, you start thinking about how you're going to take a photo and you forget to be careful that people are driving by you awfully close. So be super careful. On our website, we have some photo tips and suggestions for good places to go.
What's the location of that website again?
It's humboldtbaykeeper.org. And we'll have that on our Facebook page as well. Probably not on Twitter. You can take photos and send them to us at kingtidesphotos@gmail.com. We have a special inbox for all those photos because we tend to get a ton of massive photos, and we'll have that email address on the website as well. And you can also go to the website. You'll see a link to our Flickr page that has photo albums of previous years, King Tide Photo Initiative.
We should do an art show some future year. Get these blown up, real high-res photos, you know, get them huge, and then present them as art and make people confront this.
We've had some high and low tide comparisons during Arts Are Live, and we've also had the rolling slideshow at Ocean Night and that sort of thing. Yeah, you can't really blow up the phone photos very big.
This isn't just a Humboldt Bay project. This is something that's happening across the state of California, right?
Yeah, that's right. The Coastal Commission has taken over the California King Tides Photo Initiative now, and so there's also a site where you can upload photos to the statewide King Tide Photo Initiative. And then I will hopefully, weather permitting, be going up in a Lighthawk flight again. Delia Benskang of Surfrider Foundation and I went up with a Lighthawk pilot in December and took photos during an average tide on a really perfect sunny day. You should check out those photos on the Baykeeper Facebook page if you haven't seen them. They're amazing. But we're going to go fly around and take pictures during the extreme high tide too. Hopefully, fingers crossed, the weather will be good.
Yeah.
Murray Field won't be flooded.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
Fly from Nealand.
You've been listening to the Eco News Report. This has been another great show. Thanks to my co-hosts for joining me, and thank you for listening. Join us again next week on this time and channel for more Eco News Report.